The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by the Mysterious Package Company. Are you or someone you love a fan of Lovecraftian mysteries? Then you must check out MysteriousPackage.com/paranormal. That's MysteriousPackage.com/paranormal. Thanks, Mysterious Package Company. The Paranormal Podcast is also brought to you by Scott Evest. Great clothing plus tons of pockets for your stuff. Well, that's Scott Evest. To learn more and get a super special Scott Evest deal, go to JimHarold.com/vest. That's JimHarold.com/vest. Click on the link I provide there and use the coupon code JimHarold, that's one word, and you'll get 20% off your purchase. Thanks, Scott Evest.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold, and I am excited to be with you today. It is a big day at the Spooky Studio. First up on the show today, we're going to have a superstar author, and that cuts across all genres. We're talking about Ben Mezrich. He's the same man who wrote the book The Accidental Billionaires, and that went on to become an Academy Award-winning movie, The Social Network, all about Facebook. And now he has turned his attention to the subject of UFOs, and I love seeing UFOs get this kind of treatment. And actually, Ben told me, and he'll say on the show here, that this was the very first interview that he did for this move, for this book. I thought that was so cool. So I think you'll enjoy that. And in part two, we have a burgeoning superstar. I'm talking about Seth Breedlove. He is a filmmaker. He has two small town monster movies out, Minerva Monster and also The Beast of Whitehall. And his latest movie coming out this fall is on Boggy Creek. And we're going to talk about cryptid movie making and all the exciting things he's doing. This is one of my favorite episodes of 2016. I think you'll enjoy it. Here it is, the Paranormal Podcast. And today is a red letter day because we have one of the brightest stars of the book scene today. And he has an interesting book that is in our field. And I am dying to know how he got interested in UFOs. I'm talking about Ben Mezrich. Now, Ben graduated magna cum laude from Harvard, but he has published 18 books, including, get this, the New York Times bestsellers, The Accidental Billionaires, which was adapted into the Academy Award-winning film The Social Network. Love that movie. And Bringing Down the House, which has sold more than 1.5 million copies in 12 languages and was the basis for the hit movie 21. He's also published the national bestseller Once Upon a Time in Russia. And he is really one of the top literary lights of these days. He's often on top radio and TV shows. We're so glad to have him on the program today. Ben, welcome.
Hey, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Okay, I have to understand this. I mean, you are, I think, a mainstream author.
Right.
And you do mainstream topics. You speak at Google, well-respected. Why in the world did you decide to tackle the UFO topic, which many times is looked at askance by the mainstream?
Yeah, you know, and I definitely came at this as an outsider. I mean, I've always been interested in the X-Files television show, which I loved, and things like that. But I never really set out to do a story in this world. Basically, I heard about this guy, Chuck Zukowski, and he was a sheriff's deputy in Colorado who was fired from the sheriff's department after investigating a cattle mutilation and fell into this world of UFOs and ufology. So I approached it really without knowing that much about the world. I would say I was pretty much a skeptic at the time. And my feelings have changed over the past year of my research. I definitely came at this from a mainstream point of view. And now I'm very intrigued by this world and I've learned a lot about it. And so it wasn't something I really set out to write about, but I kind of found myself drawn into this world. We're working on the movie as well. The producer of the movie, a guy named Bo Flynn, who did the movie San Andreas, is the one who introduced me to Chuck. He was interested in this because he saw it as another Close Encounters type movie.
Sure.
But once I sort of got into it, you know, I realized this is a topic that hasn't been covered by the mainstream, and that should be. And I think it's one of these things where, you know, people have dropped the ball on this world because it's seen as fringe or not, you know, something that the average person knows anything about. And I wanted to turn my attention to it, and I got really sucked into it.
Do you think that lack of coverage is a sin of omission or a sin of commission?
You know, I think it's a mixture of the two. I think there was my opinion, and I'm not a big conspiracy theorist, but I do believe that beginning back in the 40s and 50s, the powers that be, I guess it's a weird way to say it, but the Air Force, people sort of who were in the position to know things, decided to keep it fringe by mocking it, by making it impossible for people in the mainstream to cover this topic without it being seen as a joke. I think there was a concerted effort to do this. I also believe that because of things like the X-Files and all these popular sci-fi type things, it's difficult for mainstream writers to cover it without it being seen as a joke. But I think it's a mixture of the two. I really do think that there was an effort to make it seem fringe. It's very easy, you know, for a variety of reasons to do that. And I'm not just saying because, you know, the Air Force has proof of UFOs, even if they were trying to hide some sort of a military craft they didn't want to get out. It's always easy to say, oh, you know, these are UFO crazies and that kind of thing. And so I think it kind of snowballed from the 40s, 50s onward. And now it's just gotten to the point where it is difficult to cover from a mainstream point of view.
I do want to get into the book, but I just want to make this point. Any report, particularly on local television, of a UFO sighting or something like cattle mutilation or something like that, which you cover extensively in the book, a lot of times it'll be the kicker story on a newscast. It's the last story. That's usually the humorous story. And then, of course, you have the anchor with the arched eyebrow.
Right.
And you have the field reporter, and of course, they fade in the X-Files music. It's almost a convention. So I think at this point, among at least television journalists, it's so ingrained that this is basically a story for, and I hate to use this word, but to borrow from our British friends, nutters, that let's make fun of it. And it's become a convention. It's not even a thought process. It's like covering, a potato sack race. It's a joke.
Yeah, I mean, you're completely right. You know, I fully acknowledge that every interview I'm going to do in the mainstream press over the next couple of weeks is going to be followed by X-Files music. It's going to be, you know, oh, here's another story. And I think that it's funny because it really did start off differently. And now it's gotten to that point. I mean, you know, it's something that originally in the 40s with the whole Foo Fighter phenomenon was covered on the cover of the New York Times, you know? But now it's reached a point where it's definitely that last story, that hook, that thing that gets people interested. But, you know, things are going to change again because now with the Earth-like planets being discovered and the idea of alien life is much more accepted now, that we might see a shift over the next couple of years in that way. But certainly UFOs is still in that ghetto, I guess you would say, in the mainstream, and it's interesting.
Now let's talk about the 37th parallel. Every good story needs a strong protagonist. And you talked about Chuck Sikowski. Tell us about Chuck.
Chuck is a very interesting and fascinating individual. Chuck was a sheriff's deputy in Colorado. He was also a microchip engineer, so he made microchips for a company. He was, you know, science background. He'd always been an enthusiast into sort of the idea of UFOs or things in the skies. He'd been an amateur and astronomer his whole life. But he was really sucked into this world while investigating cattle mutilations. You know, cattle mutilations is a phenomenon in the Midwest that's very well known, but sort of on the East Coast and the West Coast is not known at all. Since the, you know, 50s, basically, there's been 10,000 cows and horses found lying on their left side, missing an eye, missing a lung, usually drained of blood, with no evidence of anything, you know, any predator, no footprints. It's such a big phenomenon that in the 70s, the FBI did a 10-year investigation involving hundreds of agents and found no evidence of anything. So no one really knows what's causing these cattle mutilations. Chuck was investigating one, got fired from the sheriff's department because he started to talk about UFOs. And from there, he became a real ufologist. He got an RV, he filled it with his family, and he started going from UFO hotspot to UFO hotspot, trying to find evidence. And I really got to know Chuck. I find him fascinating. He's gregarious. He's a really interesting, nice guy. I was also fascinated. His wife is a complete skeptic, thinks he's crazy. And it's an interesting dynamic between the two because he's as much trying to prove to her that this is real as he is trying to prove to the world at large. And I think that sort of sets it up nicely for him not being this total believer, but he certainly becomes one over the course of the book. You know, he's a great guy. He's interesting. He's fascinating. When I met him, I flew out to Colorado and he picks me up at the airport, basically straps me a bulletproof vest and a gun on me and says, "We're going out looking for UFOs." Being from Massachusetts, we don't have any guns here. So I never really held a gun before. And I was like, this is, you know, this is fascinating. He's really sort of one of these guys who wants to get in the jungle. He wants to go out there and really look for it. He wants to be the first person on the scene. I just find him fascinating.
Well, it's interesting. In the book, you talk about the family dynamic, and you got this RV ostensibly to go on family vacations, and the family vacations tends to be a tour of different UFO sites. And I could see how this will work very well in a movie.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because he can't just say, "I'm going to go look for UFOs," because his wife and kids won't let him do that. So he has to plan a vacation around a UFO hotspot. And for me, it got me to sort of be able to tell the history of UFOs, to show all of these important spots and sort of the language of UFOs as an outsider, because I'm really aiming this book at the mainstream. I want this book to really change the perception in the media at large and for people at large that this is something that we should be looking at. I mean, there's an immense amount of evidence. There's an immense amount of first-person, witness accounts and things like that that people just don't look at. And through Chuck's journey, I'm able to talk about Roswell and the Taos Hum and Sedona and all these kind of different hotspots so that we can see it all as it develops and as he learns more about it.
What are some of the spots that really fascinated you that you never heard of before this project started, but now that you know about them, you're like, wow? Or are there any like that?
Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, Roswell is the one I'd heard of. Roswell is the most famous, I think. But I didn't know the details about Roswell. You know, Roswell is one of these things that has become somewhat of a joke. You know, it's the place where you go to dress up as an alien for the alien ball, or the place where, you know, you go to a restaurant shaped like a flying saucer. But the history of Roswell is much more serious than that, you know, involving a nuclear Air Force base, involving a lot of witness accounts, involving a pretty important press release put out by the Air Force at the time. I mean, there's a lot to Roswell that I did not know, that you probably knew and people in your world know better than me. Things that I didn't know anything about, you know, Dulce Mountain, the whole idea of this, maybe there's an underground base there, I knew nothing about. Sedona I'd heard of, but the idea of the vortexes and the link to the American Indian world was fascinating to me. I mean, American Indians, Native Americans, they, you know, have believed in alien visitation all the way back. And when you talk to Native Americans, they don't find this, you know, unlikely at all. And I think it's interesting to talk about that. The event in England, in the forest in England.
Rendlesham,
right, which I knew nothing about before. I guess they call it the UK's Roswell. Yeah. And I mean, that's something that's very well documented, and I knew very little about that. I think those were kind of the main ones that sort of got me more and more hooked. But cattle mutilation, I would say, is the one thing that really got me really involved, because it's such a strange phenomenon. And so many possible answers, and yet something that just has no resolution. And that fascinates me.
And maybe people who haven't studied it very closely aren't aware, but we're not just talking about cattle that are cut up with a knife or ostensibly with a knife or anything like that. There's very specific hallmarks of these incidents and very disturbing ones. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, the cuts, you know, are mostly circular. A lot of people describe them as being cut with a laser. Drained of blood. The exsanguination is something that's very bizarre. And, you know, Chuck brings these carcasses to vets, to, you know, real veterinary professors at the University of Colorado and other places. And they can't figure out what's been done to these cattle, how they've been drained of blood, how you have a scene of such violence with no blood around the carcass. Some of these animals have been dropped from heights, which is very weird. There's no footprints. You know, they'll be missing organs completely. And when you cut them open, the organs inside are desiccated. They crumble. It's bizarre. And, you know, there's no signs of struggle, you know, so it's not like the animal was fighting something. There aren't bite marks or tooth marks. So when you say it might be a predator, it would be in a very unusual predator that could cut out, you know, an animal's eye or heart with a circular wound like that. So, you know, it's not easily explained. And the FBI itself, and, you know, these FBI files are available. There was a Freedom of Information Act and they were filed and you can order them. They're very clear about the wounds being very unusual and not something that you can easily sort of throw out. There are different theories. You know, there were multiple theories when the FBI did its study. One was the idea of some sort of giant motorcycle gang doing these rituals. They had someone, it was in prison, who came forward and said, we would put cardboard on the snow so we could get there without leaving footprints and drain the blood. But it was never, you know, really believed by the FBI because there would be multiple of these cases over decades. And it seems unlikely that one motorcycle gang could be doing this for 25, 30 years. There were theories about biological testing and using these animals for some military purpose. But that idea was discounted as well, because why wouldn't the military have its own cattle? You know, why would the military need to be going on some random rancher's farm, pulling a cow up, doing this and putting the cow back? So that doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, there's no answer. I don't have the answer. But I certainly, as I looked into it, as Chuck looks into it, we get closer and closer to something. And the idea is this is a very sort of big topic that hasn't been, you know, figured out.
You mentioned Dulce. That's a very strange place. Actually, I had Bill Burns, who was the host of a program called UFO Hunters on the History Channel. He told me on the program, and actually, I guess this made kind of news. It was on his Wikipedia article that actually he got a little too close to that situation. And he claims that, again, the powers that be helped pull the plug on his show because of that. Now, I don't know if that's accurate, if his perception is correct on that. But Dulce is a very strange place.
Yeah, Dulce is very strange. It's sort of in the Native American land, so you can't just sort of wander in there. There's also a big military presence, which is not ever really explained why it's there, so you need to figure out a way to get in there. The thought is that there's an underground base there, but there's been a lot of sightings, both UFO and this whole skinwalker phenomenon, which is this American Indian phenomenon, I guess, or I don't know what the right word would be, paranormal phenomenon. There's a famous ranch called Skinwalker Ranch, which I get into in the book. Skinwalker Ranch is this place that's had bizarre sightings for many years. The ranching family that lived there was eventually chased off of it. They ended up selling it, which we'll get to, I guess, in a second. But Skinwalker Ranch and Dulce are connected in many ways. The idea is that there's some sort of phenomenon involving beasts of some sort, involving scorch marks on the ground, involving maybe vortexes. There's a lot to it. But Dulce itself is really known for the idea of an underground base dug into the mountain there. You know, people have come forward with theories about, you know, joint military alien base. I don't get into that kind of thing in my book necessarily, because I'm much more into sort of what we can figure out looking at it, you know, from an evidentiary point of view or what we can see. But certainly there's enough accounts that there's something going on there, whether it's U.S. military or something more, I don't know. But Chuck definitely found something. He definitely had an experience there, which led him to believe there's something big going on.
The book is The 37th Parallel. Our guest is best-selling author literary star Ben Mezrich, and we'll be back right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by the Mysterious Package Company. Are you or someone you love a fan of Lovecraftian mysteries? Then you must check out MysteriousPackage.com/paranormal. As I've said before, they are the most unique sponsor we've ever had on the programs in 11 years. In fact, I wish I would have thought of this. Imagine a gift that your friend or family member will never forget, unlike anything they've ever been sent. It's more than a series of packages, but an experience. Imagine getting those packages in the mail from a mysterious sender. Don't know who it's from. And in it, you encounter these weathered and historic objects and artifacts. Wouldn't that be a lot of fun? Well, that's the kind of experience that you can give a friend or a loved one. So check out MysteriousPackage.com/paranormal. And when you navigate over there to become part of the experience, you'll be in for some surprises and mysteries of your own. But there's even more exciting news with the Mysterious Package Company this week. Following up on their wildly successful Kickstarter in 2015, the Mysterious Package Company is launching a new Kickstarter known as Filigree in Shadow. It is a Victorian haunted house story, perfect for this show, inspired by the works of Edgar Allan Poe and Shirley Jackson. Themes include haunted houses, Victorian storytelling, being watched, deception, murder, death, and redemption. Filigree includes greater levels of customization and personalization, allowing you to really make this experience your own. Now, previous packages from Mysterious Package Company have touched on subjects such as Lovecraft's mythos, spiritual possession, time travel and zombies, and even South American adventure. So, go to MysteriousPackage.com/paranormal. That's MysteriousPackage.com/paranormal to become a part of the experience, support the Kickstarter, or better yet, both. Thanks, Mysterious Package Company. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. The book is The 37th Parallel. Our guest is literary superstar Ben Mezrich, best-selling author. This is his new book, The Secret Truth Behind America's UFO Highway. Now, Ben, we talked about Chuck Sikorsky a little bit. Do you think, and I guess I'm asking you to be amateur analyst for a while, do you think it's a case of maybe a little bit of over-exuberance, or do you really think that Chuck is on to something here?
I mean, that's a great question. And listen, you know, I come at this as an external observer. I try and get my to know my main characters. I spend time with them. But they're really telling their story, not as much my story. Chuck is definitely obsessed. He becomes more and more obsessed. I think when you're in this world or when you really start to dig into it, paranoia comes with the territory, because there's a lot to be paranoid about. As you get deeper and deeper into it, there are people who are looking at the same thing, who are much better funded, that have been doing this in secret for many years. And so the idea that you might be being watched or followed is not absurd. It's something that really could be happening. So it's hard to know how much of this is obsession and how much of this is real. I feel like Chuck is a very rational guy. I think he does have a lot of enthusiasm. He's very excited about it, but his efforts are all for good reasons. Chuck really, really wants to know the truth. He wants to help out these ranchers who are losing cattle. He wants the world to see what he sees. He believes probably a little too easy. He didn't initially, but I think, you know, he's become that way. But I also think he is on to something. I do think that, you know, whether there's an answer that doesn't involve aliens or does involve aliens, there is something going on. And answers aren't readily available from, you know, the Air Force or from the government. And I think that's very clear at this point. So I think his enthusiasm and his obsession is warranted. But I do think he's a fascinating personality. And I think he does get deeper and deeper into this world. It's become his whole life. And it wasn't initially, you know, he was a sheriff's deputy and he was very into that. But once he got fired from that, from just dipping his toe into this world, this became his obsession.
The skeptic would say, for example, on the topic of government cover-ups, that something this big could not be covered up. However, you bring up in the book a little thing known as the Manhattan Project, which was a pretty big deal. And it was covered up. Granted, it was in a different era. No social media, no internet, no television. Right. What are your thoughts on the ability of the U.S. government or other governments, for that matter, being able to pull off a cover up this big in terms of UFOs?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Manhattan Project is a really interesting story when you think about this, because when you talk about cover-ups, you know, the first response of most skeptics is there's no way the government can cover up something like this. When you look at what the Manhattan Project was, we're talking about 100,000 people were involved in developing the atomic bomb, only 15 of which actually knew what they were doing. So you had this massive project involving massive amounts of money, the incredible amount of people. They created two towns that were secret cities, housing thousands, tens of thousands of people who had no idea what they were working on. It was a cover-up on a scale that you can't even believe today was possible, but it was clearly possible. And when you look at that, UFOs is very small compared to that. And like I said, this is something you don't even need to really cover up that well, because it's mocked. You know, an entire town can see something flying over, you know, the Eiffel Tower, for instance, or flying over in St. Louis. You know, there was an object flying by, and 1,000 people can see that. And the next day it will be on the news and everyone will laugh about it. The Air Force can even send some general out and he'll do an interview and say, oh, yeah, probably an alien. There's no need to cover anything up when people look at it like that. There's plenty of radar data. There's plenty of officers who have come forward. There's plenty of the kind of sort of information that on any other topic would be considered evidence. But in this world, it will just be discounted. So it's a very easy thing to cover up. It, you know, in the book we talk about it, Chuck always says it would take a UFO, a flying saucer landing on the White House lawn for the real skeptic to believe that we've been visited. But the truth is, even that probably wouldn't convince everybody, because people would say, oh, you know, it's Hollywood. It's right. Just a newspaper. We don't believe the newspaper. So it's a very easy thing to cover up. And the Manhattan Project, to me, you know, I segue into it in the book because it's just a fascinating thing. When the military wants to cover something up, they can. And it's something that they can do very easily because they're set up to do that. There are plenty of secrets that they've kept, you know, for many, many years, Area 51 being one of them, which they didn't even mention the name Area 51 until it came out in WikiLeaks, essentially. So there are things the government covers up for sure. Whether UFOs are one of them or not, we don't know. But I will say, you know, the Hillary Clinton comments, and I don't know if, you know, you've talked about this,
sure.
But, you know, recently Hillary Clinton was on Jimmy Kimmel and she said one of the first things she wants to do if she's elected is to open up the Area 51 files and the UFO files. She's a believer. She's been asked, do you think we've been visited? And she said, you know, I wouldn't be surprised. Both her and Bill have tried to get these files opened up. And I think the very fact that Hillary doesn't have access to these files tells you everything you need to know about cover-ups. I mean, she was in position to be the person to see these files, and yet she hasn't seen these files. So I think that it's pretty clear that at least something's been covered up. And I'm more and more of the belief that something did happen at Roswell and in the 40s. And I'm more and more in the belief that there probably was some sort of visitation. Now, I don't believe that all of the lights in the sky are UFOs. I think 99.9% of these things are involved the military, involved missile tests, involved stealth bombers, involved drones. But I do think there's pretty good evidence that at least in one case, something did crash here.
Another fascinating case, and we've had Robert Salas on the program and Robert Hastings, who is a researcher on this, is the connection between nukes and UFOs. I'm thinking specifically of the 1967 incident at the Malmstrom Air Force Base where there were UFO sightings and ICBMs went offline, if those who claim that are to be believed. And to me, that's a fascinating case.
Yeah, I read that great book. I forget the title, Nukes and UFOs. I don't remember what the exact title was. And I looked into that. And, you know, there does seem to be a pretty interesting connection. And, you know, Roswell is one of those connections as well. That's the Air Force Base where the planes that bombed Japan were, you know, and took off from originally. And the connection is interesting because you could also say, well, that's also something that foreign governments would want to be spying on. So if somehow the Russians had some incredible technology we didn't know about, that's where they'd be using it. So, you know, it's a possibility in both ways. It also, a lot of people say, well, nuclear power is a signpost. So if you were an alien civilization and you were looking at the Earth and you were saying, when should we get involved? It would be the development of nukes. At the same time, you could say, well, what is the military most interesting in keeping secret? And that would be nukes. So there's different ways you can look at that. So yeah, I'm intrigued by it, and I definitely get into it a little bit at the book. There is a lot of evidence that of sightings around nuclear bases. The one you talked about is really intriguing because all the nukes went offline, and you have a lot of evidence to that fact, and that's something very odd. Whether that was some weird Russian technology or whether that was alien or UFO based, who knows? You know, we don't have an answer to. But I love the idea of looking more carefully at these things. I mean, my goal really is just to open the doors to this information, is to be able to look at this. Why aren't mainstream writers looking at this? Why isn't, you know, professors at universities studying this? You know, there's more evidence of visitation of UFOs than there is of many things in history. You know, I look at Cleopatra. We know less about Cleopatra than we do about Roswell. you know, and you'll have historical books written about Cleopatra, but you only have mostly fringe type books written about Roswell. And that's an interesting thing to me. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know the answer, but I do think there is a connection between nukes and nuclear power and these sightings.
So I do have to ask you this. You know, I'm guessing, and you tell me if I'm wrong or if you even want to discuss it, but has anybody come up to you and said, Ben, you know, you've got a fantastic career here going with the mainstream. Why would you want to associate your name with this crazy stuff?
Well, you know what? I'll be honest with you. Most of I think we're at an interesting time right now. And like I was saying before, the acceptance of the idea of life on other planets is higher now than it ever has been in human history. Most scientists believe there's life on other planets at this point. It would be hard-pressed to find anyone who's done any research at all in biology, in astronomy, in any of these things, who doesn't believe there are Earth-like planets out there at this point. And more people with money, billionaires, and are putting money into the search for life in other civilizations. So since I started talking about this book, and this is very new, you know, you're the first person I'm talking to about this book.
Thank you.
most of the people I've talked to have, someone has been coming up to me, you know, at almost every event I've done, and quite the opposite is saying, you know, when I used to be at the CIA, I've had a couple people like that. One guy told me a really crazy story. He was at the CIA in the 70s, and a fax came in about a Russian sighting in Russia. And 10 minutes later, all of these high-level people came into the office and did a burn order on that fax. They burned every copy of it, made everyone erase all of their computers, and they just shut that story right down. And to this day, you know, this is a guy who said it was a small little event in his career at the CIA, but it's always bothered him. People like that have been coming up to me a lot, which is great. I love hearing these stories because I do think it's something that's not really in the open. You know, it's definitely the kind of thing I don't normally write about. And at the same time, I don't feel bound by anything. One of the quotes in the book, I think it's somewhere in the book, and I had this very high-level aeronautical sort of insider involved in helping me with the book. He works at a big aerospace company. And he says, you know, this is the biggest story that the Fourth Estate, the media, has ever dropped. You know, his quote was that years from now, people will look back on this time period the same way people looked back when people thought the Earth was flat. And I think that's intriguing to me. I'd rather be in front of the curve than after the curve. And I do feel like people are changing their views about the idea that there's other intelligent life out there. And I think, you know, this book will hopefully fall into that. And in the end, listen, I wrote a book. My last one was about Russian oligarchs.
I've taken, a little different than this.
I've taken risks before. So I don't see any sort of risk in opening the door to this world.
And I know you've got other interviews to do and other people to talk to. One last question for you, and we'll share where everybody can get the book, which is basically everywhere. But do you think in our lifetimes, and does Chuck think in his lifetime, will there be any answers? Because one of the frustrating things for me, and I think many people, and I love this interview today because it's a little different. We're hearing some new things, some thought that we might have some progress, because it seems like a lot of the same. One of my first interviews I did was with Stanton Friedman back in 2005. And it seems like not much has changed since then. But I haven't been thinking as much about what you're saying about these things becoming more accepted if it's on the science side and all of these Earth-like planets and so forth. That's an excellent point. But do you think, and does Chuck think, we'll get an answer in our lifetime, or at least part of one?
Yeah, I am convinced that in our lifetime we will have an answer. I am fairly convinced that things are moving so quickly in terms of our technology that I believe pretty fully that within our lifetime there will be evidence that will be the kind of thing that you won't be able to discount. I don't have the smoking gun in my possession. I don't know if anyone has the smoking gun yet. But I do believe in our lifetime that will happen. I think it's pretty clear to me that all the evidence is pointing towards that.
That's fascinating. Fascinating stuff. Ben, I know the answer to this, but I have to ask, where can people find the book?
Sure. The book is at Amazon. It's on at your favorite indie bookstore at Barnes & Noble. It's called The 37th Parallel, and it should be available everywhere. So every airport should have it.
Very good.
Thanks.
Our guest today has been Ben Mezrich, The 37th Parallel, The Secret Truth Behind America's UFO Highway. Ben, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thanks so much. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Wow, that was just great to have the opportunity to speak with Ben about this book. And I think it is so neat that he is bringing this to the mainstream, because maybe a traditional UFO author couldn't get all the interviews with people like, I'm sure he's going to do something with the New York Times and the Washington Post and all these big networks. And a traditional UFO author, however skilled and erudite they might be, might not have that access, but Ben does. So hopefully this will bring this subject to a wider audience and kind of get rid of a little bit of the giggle factor, because Ben is a serious guy and he's not joking. And we're so glad that he turned his attention to this subject and spent some time with us. And we're so glad that our next guest spends some time with us. I'm talking about Seth Breedlove. We're going to talk about his films, Small Town Monsters, right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Scott eVest. Great clothing plus tons of pockets for your stuff. Well, that's Scott eVest. To learn more and get a super special Scott eVest deal, go to jimherold.com/vest. That's jimherold.com/vest. Click on the link I provide there and use the coupon code JimHerald, that's one word, and you'll get 20% off your purchase. Now, fall is coming, believe it or not, and it's a great time to get introduced to the world of Scott eVest. Scott eVest is a clothing company with a difference. They believe in the power of pockets, and they sew a ton of pockets into high-quality clothing. We could be talking about jackets. We could be talking about vests. We could be talking about pants. We could be talking about shirts. They do a great job. Now, what does a Scott eVest mean? It means that you're always going to be able to keep track of your stuff. Scott eVest clothing provides a comfortable way for you to carry all of your stuff, keys, wallets, phone, boarding pass, dog treats, water bottles, computer tablets, your phone. If there's something that you carry around, you can put it in your Scott eVest. It frees up your hands. You know, if you want to drink a cup of coffee, you don't have to juggle keys and all these different things, opening a door, carrying your child. With Scott eVest, you're free to do it all because you're not holding on to stuff. It's all contained in that Scott eVest. And here's something that I love. You know, I'm a big audio guy. And I love to listen to podcasts and music on the go. Well, all of their clothes, in terms of their jackets and their vests, they have this thing that they call the personal area network. It's so unique, it's actually patented. It includes a clear touch internal pocket for your device and a cord management system that integrates your headphone cord. So you basically put your jacket on, you put your vest on, you plug in, your earphones are right built into this vest. And it's fantastic. I mean, it's just one of the nicest features that they have. And Scotty Vest is designed to move with you. They're comfortable. They have things like removable sleeves, weight management system, lightweight water-resistant fabrics. So you're always prepared no matter what the weather is. And it protects your stuff. Now, recently, Scotty Vest, I was really flattered. And I just caught this. They didn't even tell me. They put me on a Twitter list of influencers, which was an honor. But I got to tell you, it's kind of funny because I'm like a little guy. These days, a ton of celebrities from Hollywood and Silicon Valley, well, they're becoming Scotty Vest aficionados just like me. And I've got a deal for you so you can become one because I'm telling you, you're going to love this. People are telling me I'm getting the vest for myself. I'm getting for other people. I'm getting the jackets for myself and other people. And universally, everybody said they love it. So you can join the club. Join me and all my Hollywood celebrity friends and go to jimherold.com/vest. That's jimherold.com/vest. Click on the link I provide there and use the coupon code JimHerold. That's one word, JimHerold, and you'll get 20% off your purchase. What a deal. Discover the power of the pocket. Go to jimherold.com/vest and use that promo code JimHerold. One word. That's one word. And you'll get 20% off your purchase. Thanks, Scott Evest. And now for part two of the Paranormal Podcast. I'm really excited about this one. Part one was very exciting, talking about the 37th parallel. But I'm equally excited about this part because I'm talking to one of my favorite people in this whole genre. And he's such a neat guy and he has such neat work. And it's just exploding and getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And he's got a big announcement he's going to make. I think this is the first place he's going to let people know some big information. So I'm really excited about that. I'm talking about Seth Breedlove. He's a film director, producer, writer, and a radio host, and he is from Ohio, so that's near and dear to my heart, and he has really made a name for himself with independent movies about monsters. In fact, his website is smalltownmonsters.com. His first movie was a very successful Minerva Monster. Then he followed that up this spring with The Beast of Whitehall, and coming up, and he's going to tell us when, is Boggy Creek Monster, the truth behind the legend. And we're so glad to have him with us. Seth, welcome to the program.
Hey, Jim. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I don't want to go over too much because you've been on a show before, but just briefly, how in the world does someone become a filmmaker, particularly on this subject? I mean, it's not really something you go to the high school counselor and say, this is what I would like to do. How did it happen for you?
Growing up, I was a film fanatic, and I don't know if we've talked about this before on the show. I don't know if I've talked about it much anywhere, but yeah, growing up, I was a huge kind of film geek, and I just watched movies constantly and kind of read books by, you know, read books by Roger Ebert and Billy Wilder. And just, I mean, cinema was kind of my thing when I was a kid, and I always wanted to go to film school. I wanted to be a filmmaker. And then I got to a point where I guess reality set in and I realized I would not logically be able to afford film school and any of that stuff. So I kind of gave up on the idea of becoming a filmmaker, and I went on with life, you know, and had a number of boring, mundane jobs. And then at some point I became a freelance reporter for the Massillon Independent and then eventually the Medina Gazette as well. Here in Ohio. And so I wrote for them for a little while. And while I was writing for them, I decided I wanted to take some of those skills I was learning and put them to use on a subject I really enjoyed. And at the time, I was very into Bigfoot. So I started researching some local cases, not local to here necessarily, but local around the country, you know, like small town cases. And I wanted to do a book called Small Town Monsters. So that was actually where the project originally started, was as this book proposal I was going to do. And at some point along the way, the book proposal was rejected, and I decided to start making Minerva Monster, which was one of the cases I documented, as a film. And at the time, I could not say that I was thinking, this is my lifelong dream coming true, you know, finally making a movie. It wasn't like that at all. In fact, it never struck me until after the movie was out that I had done something I had always wanted to do as a kid. And it wasn't for, I don't know why that is, but it just never registered. And I had a moment, I think it was actually at the Minerva Monster Day event last year where we premiered the movie, where all these people, I was actually kind of backstage standing off to the side. So I was looking at the movie from behind. I could see the movie on the screen.
Right.
And then in the foreground or in the background was, you know, me looking at the audience. I could see the audience looking forward toward me. And I think that was actually the moment where I was like, hey, all these people are watching a movie you made. So I think that was the moment where I realized that that was kind of a lifelong dream coming true. And then from there, it just became natural to want to do this because I don't know how you are, Jim. I think we're actually a lot alike in a lot of ways. We spent some time together when we went to Colorado. So I know a little bit about you. I think we're similar in that we have a passion for these things we're doing. And so we're constantly trying to better them.
Right.
And better ourselves and better our the way we work and all that kind of stuff. And that, I think, is the key. That is when I realized this must be what I'm supposed to do, what I have a desire, a drive to do, because I'm not typically that way. I'm not typically the kind of person who does a job and is just I and I'm just being honest. Like, that's just how I am. I'm not driven necessarily to find new ways to work. But when it comes to film, I'm always driven to do better, to push things further, to learn more. So I think that's how I kind of figured out this is what I need to be doing and this is what I want to be doing. Plus, you know, to be able to tell Bigfoot stories in a way I want to tell them.
Now, the thing is, I've got to say, Seth and I were on Beyond Belief with George Norrie, and we both, totally coincidentally, we're from Northern Ohio here, and met up at the airport, went out and became fast friends, and it was really enjoyable, and I agree, there are a lot of parallels. You talk about it taking a while to realize you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. When I first started this, I thought, oh, this will be a great hobby. This will be a lot of fun. And I remember when I had that epiphany, it was about 3 years after I started. And I had been kind of dabbling. And I was sitting at my daughter's t-ball game. And I was listening to another podcast. I don't know if that makes me a bad dad. But I'd been dabbling, putting out a show here and there. And then I realized all these people are sending me emails saying, when is the next show coming out? And it's like, people are actually listening to this. They want this. Give them what they want. And eventually it became a side gig. And that became my full-time job 4 years ago. And I'm so grateful to the audience that they've allowed me to do it. And I know that you have to feel the same way. There's a lot of gratitude to the people that come see your movies.
Yeah. No, that's a huge part of it. We're constantly surprised, I think, at how much people respond to the type of storytelling we're doing, because it's just different. It's a different type of documentary about this subject, I think. And we bragged a lot early on that, you know, we don't dramatize, we don't do reenactments, right. And we don't. That's kind of something we abstain from. Now, we started, and I don't want to give anything away, but we started doing some different storytelling techniques with Boggy Creek that we've never done before. I wouldn't say they're dramatic recreations. It's nothing like that, but it's more in the vein of like trying to creep people out, which is something I think the Boggy Creek story in general begs. But yeah, I don't even know where I got off on that from. But yeah, just constantly trying to figure new ways out of telling these stories and doing it in a way that I would have, as a fan of this subject, loved to have experienced for myself.
Now, before we get to Boggy Creek, because I definitely want to do that, that's the upcoming thing. Tell us a little bit about your last movie, Beast of Whitehall. What inspired that?
Yeah, and something else I guess I can announce on the show, since I haven't mentioned it anywhere else, is that Minerva and Beast of Whitehall, so Minerva Monster and Beast of Whitehall, are both available through Amazon now. So that was something that just finally got taken care of this past week. So if you want to stream them digitally, you can do that through Amazon.
That is awesome, and I want to make a point about that. The fact is, now you have an outlet where And it's increasingly the majority of people can get your content directly in their home as an independent producer. And
right.
Just like for podcasters, this is such a revolution because before you could have gone and made as many movies as you wanted, but you would have only been able to show them to the small groups without the distribution. Now you have distribution through a ubiquitous brand. And basically anybody has a phone or a computer can watch your stuff if they've got a Roku or whatever it might be, they can watch it on their television. So what you just said, I know you went over very quickly, but that's huge. Distribution these days, it's not just the purview of the big studios like it used to be.
It's massive, actually, and it's not something we could have done even a year ago. This is actually because of Amazon launching their Video Direct service for creators. So content creators can upload directly to Amazon now, and rather than before – the way this worked was you had to go through – you either were doing everything through CreateSpace, which meant that I was either going to have to upprice our product so much just to make any kind of profit off of it that it wouldn't have even been worth it, or we were going to just put it up for free. Mm-hmm. So it's massive for us. And to have that audience, there's a huge audience on Amazon. And actually what we're doing is Beast of Whitehall, if you have Amazon Prime, Beast of Whitehall is actually going to be free to view for at least a couple months. I'm actually putting Beast of Whitehall up as a free streaming service through there. So yeah, it's really fascinating because we use Vimeo to keep, you know, to post digitally our other films, but right. to be able to, which is great. I do love Vimeo, but to have Amazon's audience is kind of the big deal breaker or game changer for us, I guess. It's something we had never had until now. So yeah, it's a creator market now, and it's awesome to see that changing. And where people typically wanted, they desperately were out trying to get a distribution deal or get some sort of television deal. I kind of feel like if we can grow our audience enough, we could get to the point where we can do all this completely independent of major distributors or major networks, even. So
and
we'll
you
see
can
what
do
happens.
It, you can do the story and the message that you want, and I hate to keep bringing it back to me, but my experience has been, you know, when you get approached by whether it's publishers or you get approached by TV companies or all these things, they want to change it, they want to shape it, they want to meld it, and in the end, you're creating something that's not really yours. It's not your vision. And with distribution, whether it's movies or podcasts or books for that matter, with all the distribution that's available today to the independent creator, you're able to stay true to your art and what you want to do.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's been kind of each movie has been a learning experience too, as far as promotion and all that. Cause we handle everything ourselves. Like, I don't know, you and I talked about this a little bit, but we actually handle everything independently in house. So all the social media updating, all that stuff, it's either being handled by myself, my wife, or Brandon Dalo. So it's as small scale as you can get. But to get back to the question you had originally asked.
That I interrupted you on, so I apologize.
No, that was me. That was entirely me taking us down the rabbit trail of digital distribution. But the Beast of Whitehall is the story of the 1976 A-Bear incident that occurred in Whitehall, New York, which is at the base of the Adirondack Mountains. Our movie kind of tracks the A-Bear incident, which we've talked about on the show before, so I don't really think I need to go tons into like what that story is about. But basically it revolves around eight members of law enforcement and three teenage kids having a sighting of an upright walking, hair-covered, red-eyed creature back in 1976. But our film kind of tracks that incident and then how it affected the town of Whitehall, New York, and how it affects the culture of the entire Adirondack region. And while Minerva Monster delved a little bit into that, you know, the small town implications of these legends, Beast of Whitehall is much more what I had originally envisioned small town monsters being. So it focuses not just on that original case, but also, you know, the small town and in Whitehall, it's the entire region. So the Adirondack region around it as well, which, you know, for me, it's a big part of what inspired me to do these films in the first place. Is I grew up in a small town, so I'm as fascinated by how a small town reacts to a local legend and how they kind of perpetrate that legend and continue how the legend continues to grow over time. I'm as fascinated by that stuff as I am the sighting stories that usually take place to lead up to that legend becoming a local staple.
Well, I think that it's a certain – there's a certain legitimacy. There's a certain – what's the word I'm looking for? Genuineness, that opposed to let's go in and get some creepy footage and slap something together. And I think you're kind of doing this from a grounded place, from a place of respect and a place of wanting to tell a story. And I think that's very cool. We're going to have more with Seth Breedlove from Small Town Monsters. And next we're going to talk about Boggy Creek Monster right after this on – The Paranormal Podcast.
If you enjoy adult coloring books, check out the True Ghost Story adult coloring book inspired by Jim's Campfire podcast and books. Creepy coloring fun created by illustrator Len Peralta. Find it at Amazon, or for the direct links, go to jimharoldbooks.com. Now, back to the show.
We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is filmmaker Seth Breedlove. He has two movies out, and the third is coming out soon, and we're going to find out when. He's going to make an announcement on the show. Minerva Monster was his first movie. Beast of Whitehall was the second. And upcoming is Boggy Creek Monster. Now, I've got to believe, Seth, that part of the inspiration for this, I bet you at one time or another, you watched that classic horror movie, docudrama, and, you know, some people have fun with it, but it's a classic. Mm-hmm. The Legend of Boggy Creek. Is that how you found out about all of this?
No.
Okay.
Hilariously enough, Brandon Dalo, my producer, we talk about this a lot. For a lot of people who are into the subject of Bigfoot, it actually stems from that movie. And whereas with me, I didn't see that movie until 2 years ago. So I actually read Lyle Blackburn's book, The Beast of Boggy Creek, before I had seen the movie. So the book kind of made me want to go back and see the movie. But what I did find was a movie that I was extremely impressed with, and I still am impressed by it today. And I think I wrote some narration that's in the movie that addresses the fact that movie is kind of lampooned today. It's considered kind of a B-movie staple, sure, you know, and all this stuff. But to me, I see so much in that movie that I find to be of a higher quality than I expect from most 1970s horror films. I really think the cinematography in it, for the most part, is extremely epic in scope, and the way the framing of the shots is and all that stuff. The way he keeps the monster hidden puts me in mind of Jaws. You know, like you don't see this monster much, which is probably for the best, because I know for a fact that costume was not great. But they keep him in shadow so much that it actually makes it creepier, because you're constantly wondering, well, what is that thing? You know, and when you do see it, it's just the eyes or some shadowy kind of movement. But I think Charles Pierce was an indie film pioneer in a lot of ways, because mm-hmm. he went out and raised that money to make that movie for himself. And, you know, I mean, he was up against a wall when he made it, and he did something that hadn't been done before, which was this docudrama style. They call it a docudrama. Today, I really think today you would just call this a found footage movie, because it purports to be a documentary. In a lot of ways, you have these talking head interviews, you know, interviews with the locals and things like that interspersed throughout the film. And then surrounding it are these kind of overly dramatized scenes. But I really feel like it's a precursor for the found footage genre. And I am actually a big fan of a lot of things about it, especially the score. I think the score is really good. And the creature scream and there's a lot of really memorable scenes in it. The Searcy House scene is probably one of my favorite scenes in the movie. And Jim, as I'm saying this, I'm realizing I haven't even done a show where I could talk to someone about the movie because we didn't have a rough cut done until about a week ago. So you're actually the first person I'm even going to get to speak to about Boggy Creek as a film.
Now, I will mention the movie The Legend of Boggy Creek from 1972. I'm looking here now, if you trust Wikipedia, budget $160,000, box office, and this is back when $20 million was a lot of money, $20 million. So it was, needless to say, I think they did pretty well with it, and there were several sequels. Now, on to your Boggy Creek movie. You mentioned Lyle Blackburn. Now, mm-hmm. you worked with Lyle on this, didn't you?
yeah, really closely, and he's still continuing to be heavily involved with the production. So Lyle actually approached us about making this movie back when Minerva was just wrapping up production. He was on my podcast, Saswat, and him and I were talking before the recording, and he said, hey, if you're ever interested in doing a documentary about Boggy Creek, let me know, because I'd love to do something like that. So that was where the idea came from. Now, originally, we were supposed to do a Momo movie after Minerva Monster, and that fell through, so Beast Boy Hall came in between. But yeah, Lyle approached us first, and then the way we worked on the film is he put together the interview list and went ahead and made the calls ahead of time that I would be calling people, you know, to get them in the movie. So it was very different from Minerva or Whitehall in that he did a lot of that prep work for me. So we had a pre-planned interview subject list. I went through that list. We got all those people. And then there were, obviously all the preliminary research was done by him for the most part. Now, we did have story beats I knew I wanted to hit. I'm a big fan of hitting these notes about the town and, you know, how the town was influenced by the story. And in this case, you have, well, how was the town impacted by the release of this movie that went on to, you know, make 20 some million dollars and be screened all over the country. So we hit that as well, which isn't covered as dramatically in the book, I don't think, not from this angle, which is, you know, more about the small town monster aspect of it. But we worked together extremely closely and continue to today. I think he actually just emailed me a whole list of photos today that I needed for a section I'm editing right now. But it's been a completely different kind of experience for me, especially compared to the other movies, which were very basically just Brandon and I or me and the guys we worked with on Minerva Monster. It's just been a, you know, very, very kind of different. And then also Lyle's in the movie, which is the closest thing I can compare it to is in Beast of Whitehall, we have an investigator named Bill Brann, who is in that movie as well. Mm-hmm. And Bill would be on the scene with Brian Gosselin, who saw the creature back in 1976. And Bill kind of walked around with him and had him show him where some of the incidents happened. We do something very similar with Lyle in this movie, but Lyle's also narrating the movie. So it's a first person narrated kind of experience, taking you through the entire history of the Boggy Creek story from start. I mean, literally like the 1800s, you're hearing the 1800s kind of accounts of Bigfoot in Arkansas. And then it brings you all the way up till like last week. There's actually a clip in the movie that would be from when we were filming back in April. So it's the most concise history of that story I've ever seen. And it's because of Lyle's, you know, kind of carrying you through it as the storyteller.
It's interesting because, particularly since we got to know each other in the trip out to Colorado, you seem like a very level-headed person, and you're interested in this stuff. Now, have your opinions evolved over time? For example, when you first went into this, you may have been interested but maybe skeptical. And if I'm putting words in your mouth, you let me know. But has your perspective changed on time where this has kind of made you look at this and say, hey, there's really something here? I mean, what are your thoughts?
I continue to be pretty skeptical. I think what continues to sway me more toward the positive side of the fence rather than the skeptical negative side of the fence is that the stories, the historical accounts especially, continue to sway me further. And it's because I just don't see how you can dismiss a story that took place in the early 1900s where a girl claimed she saw a creature, one of these types of creatures, washing its feet in this river. Actually, it was the Sulphur River Bottoms. It was down in the river bottoms, washing its feet. She saw this as a young girl. I think she was, 8 years old, I believe. She was cane fishing with her family. She saw this creature. She did not tell anyone the story until her deathbed. I can't understand why a story like that would be made up, you know, and the newspaper articles and all that kind of, you know, the historical stuff continues to pull me further over toward the believer side of the fence just because of the historical veracity of it. And I can't dismiss that stuff. You know, that you
right.
Sighting reports are a dime a dozen. You know, we get tons of sighting reports, and so many of them can be hoaxed or fake nowadays. But, you know, when you're talking about a story from the late 1800s that ran in a newspaper in Arkansas about an upright walking creature covered in hair following swamps or you know, following creeks and rivers, it just rings very true to me. I don't know why.
What is unique, do you think, to the Boggy Creek story? Why is it different than Minerva or Whitehall or any host of different accounts in different parts of the country? What makes this one special?
It's huge. The scope of this film is so massive that as of right now, the rough cut is clocking in right around 72 minutes. But I think, you know, we have a lot of work to do. There's narration and all kinds of stuff we got to put in. There's little stories we're telling. I'm honestly believing this movie might be a 90 minute film. I'd prefer to keep it closer to 70, but that's just because I'm a big fan of shorter projects. But the scope of the story is so massive, Jim. It starts in the 1800s, and there are so many different players involved, and each of them was impacted in such a huge way. You know, the Whitehall story is amazing, and I love it, but at its heart, it's really a story about Brian Gosselin and the Gosselin family and their interaction with that creature, and then the town kind of reluctantly at coming to grips with the fact that, you know, Bigfoot is a part of their local culture. Minerva is very much just about the one family. Other people have had sightings of Bigfoot in the area, but at the end of the day, Minerva Monster is about the Caton family. With Boggy Creek Monster, the story is about the Searcy family. It's about the Crabtree family. It's about Lyle Blackburn. It's about Doyle Holmes. It's about Terry Sutton. I mean, and I'm not even coming close to mentioning ever Jennifer Bland and Heather Owens. I mean, we have so many people that are involved in this story and so many different kind of notes we have to hit in the film that to compare the three movies, it's actually kind of cool because each film is its own little thing. You know, it's very unique in that Minerva Monster feels like a 1970s paranormal haunted house kind of movie. And whereas Whitehall feels more like an episode of In Search Of to me. That's what it feels like.
One of my all-time favorites, yeah.
Yeah, and then Boggy Creek Monster is something I've never seen in Bigfoot cinema. And I'm saying that honestly. Like I try not to trump up the movies we're doing too much when I'm doing podcasts or shows or whatever, but I really feel like the story we're telling is so huge in scope that I've never seen one single case documented this extensively on film before. And it's really fascinating to me to watch. And I can tell you right now, the ending scene is my favorite thing I've ever shot. I've never shot anything and then seen it come together in post-production so well. It almost had me in tears, which I hate to say, because to say that about your own stuff, but it's not about me. I didn't shoot this scene. I wasn't even, actually I was holding the gimbal, but it all came together so naturally when we did it. And then when the pieces aligned at the end, when we were editing, I was like, holy crap, like all these pieces of this puzzle come together perfectly because of the story itself. The story, there's an honesty to the story itself, to the reality of the creature, to the reality of the story, you know, the reality of the history of the Falk monster. And all we're doing is putting those pieces of the puzzle together. And when you see that align, when you see the pieces of the puzzle kind of align at the end of the movie, it's absolutely fascinating. I've never had that experience with editing anything we've done before, where you see everything come together perfectly in such a natural way. So, I mean, the short answer is the movie's epic. It's massive and epic. And the amount of stories and sighting reports and fascinating anecdotes that are kind of tied into it. And I mean, I'm talking about all these guys, you know, the Searcys and the Crabtrees. I'm completely leaving out Charles Pierce, who made Legend of Boggy Creek to begin with. So you got to also filter it through that lens of, well, there was also this mega famous independent horror movie tied to all of this.
How did the townspeople feel about what you did, the people in the area? What did they have to say about it? I mean, obviously the movie's not out yet, so I don't know. They probably haven't seen it. But what has been the initial reaction from the time you spent down there?
Initial reaction from being down there from pretty much everyone. I didn't speak to anyone who was negative about it, but they were happy we were there. The sheriff who actually investigated the Ford incident, which the Ford incident is like the famous scene in the film, right? It's like the right. Bigfoot hand comes through the window while mm-hmm. the guy's on the toilet, and then the shootout at the house and all that happens. That's the Ford incident. The sheriff who actually investigated that incident, we interviewed him in the film, and he told us he was happy we were down there continuing to document that legend. And he said that means a lot to him personally. So, and we had a few different people tell us about that. You know, Frank McFerrin, who's he runs the local museum down there. He told us the line is actually in the trailer that's going to drop, I think, sometime next week. But he said before Boggy Creek, no one knew what Falk was. No one knew where Miller County, Arkansas was. Now you say Boggy Creek or you say Falk and everyone says, oh, the Falk monster, Boggy Creek, legend of Boggy Creek, kind of put them on the map. So they're embracing it in a way that we've seen with towns like Whitehall and Minerva are.
Well, you know, I think it's great work. I, on so many levels, I love what you're doing. I hope you continue to do it. And I'm looking forward to Boggy Creek. When exactly is it coming out?
Yeah, the official release date is November 11th. So it's one of these things where a lot of people, and on our Kickstarter campaign, we said winter, and we might have even said winter 2017. I can't remember, but I wasn't 100% sure the movie would be done before Christmas. So the goal here was to get it out late, you know, kind of late fall, so we could still get in that, you know, Halloween time. So, I mean, I think we're releasing it at the absolute perfect time. Now, that date, November 11th, is the premiere date. So we're planning on premiering it, and I don't have any details yet on the premiere. The what we're hoping we can do is premiere it down in Arkansas that weekend, like we do with our other movies. You know, we did that in Whitehall and we do that in Minerva. We invite the people to come out and watch the movie and we show the movie. So we're hoping to do that on November 11th. As far as like shipping dates, it should November 11th, I would imagine, if the movie's ready to go, it should be up on Amazon by then too, and Vimeo. So if you want to stream it on the release date, you'll be able to do it through there. And then, as always, you'll be able to order it through shop.smalltownmonsters.com. So November 11th, everything should be kicking. That's the plan. So we'll see. If the only thing I could see happening that would possibly disrupt that plan would be, we have talked to a network or two about the film being on TV. So personally, it's like you and I were talking about. Personally, I would prefer to maintain control over these and release them on our own time and that kind of thing. So I'm not even sure I would buckle.
Well, I think that, you know, if you still have control of the project and it's your project, I mean, hey, then that's a little different story than if they're taking creative control. So we wish you the best with that. Well, I'll tell you, it's great what you're doing. And remind people of your website. They want to check out everything and just get a sense of what you're all about. What's the website they can go to again?
Smalltownmonsters.com is where you can check out, you know, all that. It's, as of right now, it isn't updated, but we are working on a brand new version of the website. So hopefully with Boggy coming out and all that stuff, that'll be available by the time people listen to this. I'm not sure. It should be up soon. But shop.smalltownmonsters is also where you can buy the products and shirts and all that kind of stuff we sell.
Very cool. Our guest has been Seth Breedlove. He is a filmmaker. And stay tuned for all the exciting developments with this Boggy Creek project. And I'm sure there'll be even more things coming down the pike. Seth, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us today on the Paranormal Podcast. Again, as I said at the beginning, this is one of my favorite shows of 2016. I hope you felt the same way. And I hope that you'll tell a friend. You know, something that I like to suggest is literally, with their permission, take your friend's smartphone. They should probably be present and say, I'm going to subscribe you to something that you're going to love. It's called the Paranormal Podcast. And of course, there's Jim Harold's Campfire. Now, this is assuming that the person likes paranormal topics. But if they do, I think that they will thank you. And my goodness, there's so many ways to listen today. You've got the podcast app on the iPhone, and on Android, you have any number of solutions: iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio. The list goes on and on. So it used to be in the old days, you know, if you didn't have an iPhone, it was hard to find a way to listen. Not so anymore. They're great solutions. Many apps for both iOS and Android. If you don't like that built-in podcast app on the Apple products, you can certainly find a ton of podcatchers and different ways to listen to us, including things like iHeartRadio and Spotify and so forth and so on. So there's no excuse. So if you want to help us, that's one specific free way you can help us. Get your friend's smartphone who loves the paranormal with their permission and say, hey, I'm going to do you a big favor today. I'm going to get you access to these free podcasts. Do it for them. See what they think. Well, we thank you so much for tuning in. We appreciate it. And we will talk to you next time on the Paranormal Podcast. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.